Hey everybody, this is Jill Haney. Now that Hammered is a wrap, and we've gone through chapters 1 through 11, which brought me to present day, I started going through these early recordings, kind of these, I guess you could call them archives, and I've decided to go ahead and publish these onto our podcast platform and channel before we start the Porchcast. And that way, each Monday, since we've been having an episode come out each Monday, we'll go ahead and fill those in until the Porchcast starts, which will be several weeks away. But I wanted to give you a heads up on these recordings because these were the very first recordings that after I was approached by someone with a little microphone to, you know, send her a couple of little stories that she would consider, I guess, slice of life. And this is kind of what came out. And these recordings are very raw. And, you know, I kind of want to give you the heads up on some of them are very emotional. And looking back on these and listening back on these, which I haven't in 3 years, it's kind of crazy because I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, damn, you know, I've come a long way in 3 years, but I think, you know, what I've talked about this a lot is that by telling your story and listening to your story or writing your story and reading your story, it really shines a spotlight on some things. And for me, it really has shown me some of the victim consciousness that I had been living in for a very long time. Now, I'm not saying that I was walking around like a victim, because that's not what that means. A victim consciousness is when, you know, we're all victims of something, whether it be abuse or, you know, the media or whatever. I mean, we've all been a victim of something in our lives. But for me, I think having on an unconscious level this sort of it's almost like you're looking over your shoulder. It's a feeling of nobody really knows me. And it's just sort of this defensiveness, I guess you could call it. And I have found myself in my life defending myself many, many times when I didn't need to. But it was because of this victim consciousness. And I think, and I hear it coming out of people a lot of times, how we all kind of fight for our limitations. You know, if you ask somebody, or you know, somebody asked me a question about, say, juicing, for instance, and I'll say, oh yeah, well, you know, I make green juice and I drink it every day. And the minute that I start telling them my experience with that, it turns into, oh, well, I couldn't do that because I can't do that because, oh, it takes too much time. And there's always, and they fight for their defensiveness. You know, they fight for their limitations. And I just give up. I don't say another word because it's like, you know, that's your deal. You do whatever you got to do for yourself, but this is what I have to do. But it's just so interesting to me. So I don't know. I've had to really look at my own limitations and how I hold myself back, but I do feel like I've grown leaps and bounds since the beginning of these recordings. So we're going to release these out. And like I said, I'm just giving you a heads up on some of the emotion and some of the rawness of some of this stuff might be a little bit disturbing. I don't know. Kind of disturbs me, but whatever. So enjoy and keep Hammered going, and please subscribe to my Hammered YouTube page, whether you listen on YouTube or not, because the more subscribers that I can get on YouTube, then eventually I could get some sponsorship and get out of doing stonework, because that's my ultimate goal. I want to start using my voice and my brain instead of my body. So happy listening, and here we go. I woke up thinking about Gloria Steinem this morning.
I actually saw her new movie. It wasn't her movie, but a movie that was made starring Julianna Moore came out a couple weeks ago. And I really liked how they used her child and adolescent and adult self riding the bus and kind of going through these stages of her life. And I could identify with those different parts of the psyche. And it was just real interesting to see how they worked it and how her older self, you know, would go back and communicate with those younger selves or vice versa. And it reminded me of doing some psychomotor work back in the 90s, this Gestalt therapy stuff that you have to enroll your adolescent self or your childhood self or your young adult. And then, you know, of course, ideal parents and la, la, la. But anyway, so I could sort of identify with a lot of it. And I started thinking about my own journey and how, you know, sometimes things that I thought were insignificant at the moment were major turning points or these light bulbs of awareness around a certain thing. And watching the movie about her, she had so many different experiences all over the world, and she was such a good writer, and she was just so able to capture what was happening in her words. And I always wanted to be a writer, but when I do write things down and I read it back, it just doesn't come out the way that I'm trying to say it. So I thought, well, hell, just say it, you know. So that's kind of what I'm doing here. And, you know, one scene is when she's at the Playboy Mansion, you know, and she kind of gets in. She wants to get a job there, and she ends up working there. But she starts seeing how, you know, the discrimination and the abuse and all that's going on. So she's kind of undercover. And I just thought it was pretty brilliant how she, you know, came out and did her article and all that. But I don't know. I have so many stories about discrimination and men just totally berating you. And I mean, Jesus Christ, it's like the story of my life. And it's like I don't even know which ones to talk about because there's so many. But one that kind of came to mind this morning when I was kind of thinking of all this, because it just kind of starts running through my head. I had saved a bunch of money when I had my landscape company in Atlanta called Enchanted Gardens. And I was pretty successful for a small little business. And so I saved this money and I ordered a brand new vehicle. I had never ordered from a vehicle in my life, but it was a Toyota Tundra. It was the first year that they ever made a full-size truck. And I was so excited to order this thing. And, you know, and so it came in and the guy, you know, Roswell Toyota called me up and I showed up and I kept trying to give them a lot of cash. And they were like, no. Don't you want to just finance this? Don't give us all that money. I said, no, I want to pay down half. I don't want a big old car payment. And it was like this battle, you know, and finally, you know, they took the money and I got the truck. And so that was kind of a little, you know, already putting a damper on what could have been like a fun day or a reward. I mean, Jesus, I worked very hard and I barely ever bought myself anything. I don't buy a lot of material things, but when I do, I go for something, you know, like a Thermador oven. I mean, so anyway, I left the parking lot and I pulled out onto Roswell Road and I go down the road and I, you know, of course it's on E, so I needed some gas. So I pull into this gas station and get out and I start pumping the gas and, you know, I'm just standing there kind of looking at this truck like, dang, this thing is really, it's very nice, had gray leather seats and it was white and it was just really pristine, you know, and I was very proud. And so I'm standing there and a car, this rattly ass looking fucking Nissan Sentra pulls up right across from me. So I'm standing like with my back leaning against my truck with the gas pumping. And then this guy gets out of this old Nissan. And yeah, he's kind of middle-aged and kind of, you know, snarl on his face. And he lifts the gas thing, puts the gas nozzle in his car, and he leans back on his car and he kind of looks me up and down, you know, with his gut hanging over his belt and his receding hairline. And you, fuck yeah, I'm being judgmental. I'm just telling you what exactly what I saw. And he folds his arms over his gut and he looks me up and down and he goes, "God damn, you mean to tell me your husband let you drive that brand new truck with a sticker still in the window?" And, you know, I had this like surge of like energy go through my gut and my body. And all of a sudden, it's like this devil angel moment. There's a devil on one shoulder and there's an angel on the other shoulder. And there's two ways that I can play this. And it's how much energy do I want to put into this? How much do I want to spend on this person in this situation, in this moment? And so I thought about it for a minute, and then I just immediately looked at him in the eye, and I said, "No, he must really love me. I mean, I can't believe he let me drive it either." And that immediately diffused it. And he giggled. He goes, "Well, that's a fine looking truck. That's a good looking truck." And I said, "Yeah, it's a 2000. It's right off the assembly line." And he, you know, we stopped the gas and we put the gas caps back on and said goodbye. And I got in the truck. And I was sort of shaking, you know, and I thought, "God dang it, why didn't I say something? Why didn't they say, 'Fuck you, bitch'?" Because that's what I really wanted to say. But it was one of those moments where I have to pick those battles each day. And so there's an art form to it. There's a way of, it's almost like you can, it's like telling someone to go to hell and them thanking you. But I just, you know, I drove away, but I thought, you know, now there's two experiences already within a mile radius that have rained on my fucking parade about getting my new truck. Now, okay, here we go. Do I let someone steal my peace? It's my responsibility to not give away my power. It's my responsibility how I interpret these things. I could have stood in my truth back at the dealership and not let them push me around with the money. You know, I could have nipped it in the bud sooner than I did. I didn't have the tools. I didn't know how to do that. Nobody ever taught me that. You know, and going back to Gloria Steinem, you know, every time that a snippet would come on TV on the news of Gloria Steinem or, you know, Angela Davis or, you know, some strong woman, my mother, usually making dinner over in the kitchen, would peek out under the hood vent and see them on TV and be like, "Oh, I can't stand her. Somebody needs to shut her up." And I remember thinking, I was only, you know, probably 8 or 9 years old, somewhere in there. But I remember thinking, if she doesn't like them, I do. Because I knew in my gut that what they were saying was more of the truth than what she would say. And then I'm thinking, you know, she came home from a job. She was a working mother. So how was she able to have a job? You know, and you think about the rights that women got, but they don't even really know how those rights came about. Or if they do, they just bury it and they don't acknowledge it. But that day was kind of sad, you know, and I look back and think, you know, I didn't have a support system in that arena in my life. I had therapists and I had groups and I had self-help and I had 12 steps and things like that. But just a close, intimate person in my life at that point that could really get what I was talking about. And that's, I think, the crux of all of this, is that it's so important to have that one or two people in your life that you can tell these things to, and that they really get it, that they've been there, they understand it. And it's very hard. It's been very hard for me to find through all the years. You know, I started out at 24 years old working in landscape in a man's, back then what was a man's profession. And it has evolved into doing massive stone projects. And I feel like that I'm just now getting started sometimes, you know. I never have really approved of my work that much. I've always critiqued it very harshly and never given myself a break. I'm always working on improvement and learning and trying to do better. And but I do feel that I'm in a place in my life now at almost 59 years old that I can name prices and not feel weird about it. It's like, no, I fucking earned this. But you know, men and a lot of women, too, always try to beat you down in price. And I think because I'm female, they think it's supposed to be cheaper for some reason and are less expensive. OK, we'll reword it. But to them, hell yeah, they mean cheaper. So it's always a process of going in. And I had a man recently, a friend of mine's husband, who I really like. He is hilarious. He reminds me of Jerry Seinfeld, and I just love him. And he didn't even know how much he helped me. We sat out on his deck one night talking about, you know, going out and pricing things. And he looked at me and he said, Jill, you've got to stand in the discomfort. You know your value. And they don't. But stand in that discomfort and it can earn you thousands of dollars. Just be tough. Stand tough. And it really helped me because I've always been such a people pleaser, such a fixer. And so it's really helped me to turn some things around, and I'm very grateful for that, and I'm very grateful for him. So this journey of equality is never ending. I don't know if there'll ever be a graduation. I don't know if we'll ever get to a place where it's like, yeah, we're equal. I know that there's leaps and bounds, but you know, with all the things that are happening in government and politics and all the hate and all the discord, it's just sad. It's so sad to me. And I have another real good friend that she was a historian in the White House for many, many years. I think she was there from Nixon until Bush number two, and she finally got out, moved to Asheville. And I did all of her stonework, but we became really good friends, which was pretty hilarious because she was very formal. And she asked me to come in the house one day. It was 17 degrees and I was out working in her yard. And she said, I insist that you come in here and have your lunch. And I had my blue cooler that I've had for a million years. And I said, no, it's okay. I'm used to being outside. She goes, get in the house. So I came in and I sat over in the corner of the kitchen. She was like putting up some dishes and just sort of, you know, being a person. And I'm like over there kind of cowered over my lunch, eating my tuna, kind of like a cat, you know. And she looks at me and we kind of tell a little bit of our history. I don't dare go into the real history because, you know, it just shock people, but maybe not. But we got a little deeper and a little deeper and it started to be kind of funny, you know, and she looked over at me and she was holding a coffee cup or a dish or something. And she goes, you know, my dear, we would have never run in the same circles, but I feel like we would be really good friends. And I just lost it. I laughed my head off. I said, well, honey, you wouldn't have been running in my damn circle. And we laughed. We had a good laugh about that. But that started a really good friendship, and I'm still friends with her. It's like 15 years later, and we're still really good friends, and I go to her for a lot of advice. But one thing, after the 2016 election, she's the first person I called the next day. And I said, can we just meet? Like, I just need to talk about this. And she said, sure. So we met at a restaurant, and I said, all right, I'm not going to talk. I'm going to zip it. You just talk. And so she looked at me and she said, what we're witnessing, my dear, is the demise of democracy as we know it. And she said, the Russians have been at this for years. And then I said, well, but how can women go there? How can women support this? I cannot grasp this. And she said, in Washington, we called women like this men's women. I said, men's women? What the fuck does that mean? And she said, well, it's a woman who believes that she has a personal identity, but she really doesn't. She said her identity has been formed by her father, her brother, her teacher, her preacher, her pastor, her coach, the man figure in her life, whatever man figure in her life. And she said, but ultimately, God. And God is a man, of course. And she's atheist, so, you know, we kind of laughed about that. But she said, they really don't have an original thought in their head. It's all something that they have been taught or heard along the way. And it sort of made sense to me, you know, and I started thinking about all the women in my family. I thought about women like growing up, you know, just kind of women that never said a whole bunch, that were married to very dominating asshole, motherfucker, abusive men. I guess he was an uncle of mine or great uncle, just horrible, horrible guy. And I remember his wife just being so passive, and she was very sweet. And I've always felt sorry for her. But I remember, you know, walking to a door. It was like it was one of the holidays, and all the men like went into the den and smoking pipes and cigars, and they're all sitting there watching football. And, you know, the women were like hens cackling in the kitchen, you know, cleaning up the dishes and washing the dishes and talking and sitting around the table. And, you know, and I was sort of in between, and I wanted to go in there and watch football because I watched it with my brother at home all the time. And I went to the doorway, and I remember that uncle looking at me, and he like held his pipe out, like took it out of his mouth and just stared at me. And what I was getting from him was, don't you dare cross that threshold and come in here. And they all sort of turned to my brother and my cousin, were laying on their stomachs in the floor, watching up real close to the TV, you know, with their hands, their chin, and on their fist. And they even turned around and looked. And it was just silence. And the message I got was, you're not allowed in here. And so I went outside, and I think me and my sister went and played in the woods. But, you know, just those kind of feelings of, why can't I come in there? And it all goes back, you know, to wanting to be equal. I didn't even know I wanted to be equal. I just wanted to participate. I just wanted to be part of. But I didn't fit in their world, and I didn't fit in the kitchen with the cackling. You know, I mean, I could sit around and listen to it, but, you know, they'd start talking about purses and shit, and it would be like, oh, just shoot me. So I guess over the years, being in a so-called man's profession and having to deal with vendors and stone yards and landscape, you know, all that world, and having to navigate through it, I've kind of learned how to do it in a way that is very pleasing. And matter of fact, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I pulled into the Toyota dealership down in Hendersonville, and, you know, not one of them's wearing a mask. They think that COVID is a hoax. And I pull in, and I've got my mask on, and I have a big old boulder in the back of the truck, and they just think it's hilarious. And they just flock around me when I pull in there, and I'm thinking, why did they like me so much? This is so weird. Like, men never liked me, but there's something about either my honesty or the things I say. I just don't really know what it is, but they come rushing up, and they're like, what are you working on? Well, look at that tailgate. Oh, my God, you're tearing that truck up. When are you going to get a new truck? When are you going to let us get you a new truck, Jill? Come on. You know, it's like old home week. And so, you know, one guy, he says, come on, let's go walk. And we walk around and we sat on a bench and he had moved to Florida. He's young. He's got a young wife, two kids, little kids. And I become his counselor for the next 45 minutes. I've known this guy for like, you know, 8 years. And, you know, and I sit there and I'm telling him just, I said, you're always being prepared, you know, you're always being prepared. So just know that you're exactly where you're supposed to be. And I'm telling him all this stuff. And I can tell he's very appreciative. And, you know, we walk back and I spent hours down there because I had to have some work done on my truck. But it's just baffling to me how biased men can be about equality, but then they can approach someone like me and treat me pretty equally. If I'm, maybe they just want to sell me a truck. I don't know, but I don't get that. I get that they do like me and they think it's funny that, you know, my truck is more banged up, I guess, than any guy that comes in there. Most men protect their truck like they're, you know, their little baby. But I actually use mine for work, which is sort of different than most male American men. They don't like to get a scratch on their truck. So anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I don't know. Equality. Can't we just fucking be equal? Why not? You know, we all have the same blood. It's all red. It's all going to come out of us. Why can't we just call it? I actually had the opportunity to meet Gloria Steinem sometime, probably mid-90s. It was after the Olympics, because there had been a couple of bombs. One was set off at a women's gay bar, and then another at the Centennial Park at the Olympics. And then where I lived, which was out in Marietta, Georgia, they had a bomb attempt at a gay family picnic, which was going to be held. It was held on a Sunday. I lived two blocks from there. And that really shook me up because, you know, I just worked all the time. I didn't have a big social life in Marietta, Georgia. Most of the people that I had become friends with lived, a lot of people lived in town, more close to the city, some out there where I was. But I had kind of started to go into the city more to, you know, do things more with more culture as far as art and theater and movies and restaurants and stuff like that. So I didn't spend a whole lot of time out where I lived, but I did work a lot out there. I worked in the East area, which was kind of this this new money sort of place, you know, where they all had Hummers and shit. But anyway, so Gloria Steinem came to Cheris Bookstore, which was in Little Five Points. And a friend of mine had told me about it. And she was like my mentor person in my life and a few of the women that she sort of helped along the way. And so we, as a little group, went down there to see Gloria Steinem. And she had a new book that had come out. And she was going to talk about the book and then, you know, take questions and things. And surprisingly, there were only about, say, 25 people there. So it was a really small group and it was very intimate. And I really loved it because we were like right there and she was sitting at a table and it was just really cool to be there and to listen to her because I had read, you know, her books and had sort of always paid attention to her. I mean, I wasn't a groupie or anything, but I did like her and I liked her demeanor. I liked her calmness. There was something very soothing about her voice, about the way she sat and listened to people and responded, and she took her time when she answered questions. It was just a really good experience. And so after, you know, we stood in line to get our book signed and we could ask her questions if we wanted to. And so when I got up to her, I just, you know, she signed my book. She asked me my name and she signed, you know, to Jill Gloria Steinem, basically. And I said, can I ask you, like, And I started telling her about, the bombs, and she knew that that had happened. I said, well, I'm just nervous. I said, it's a climate we're in, and recently a girl was out pumping gas. She had like a Ford Explorer, and she had a rainbow flag sticker on the bumper of her vehicle. This is out where I live, and this van full of guys came by and literally pushed her in the back of their van and drove her off and beat the shit out of her and dumped her out on the side of the road. They didn't kill her, but they got her just for having the rainbow flag. And I was telling Gloria about that, and I said, I said, I work in kind of the man's world, and I have to wear work boots and work clothes. And, I mean, I'm masculine, but not that much. And she listened real closely. And I said, but, if you live somewhere like that, how do you survive it? How do you not get sucked into the way people look at you? Because I would walk into, say, like a Home Depot or something and just get looks. I get these looks from men a lot of times, like in my vehicle or whatever. But she said, you have to find your tribe. And she said, sometimes that means moving. And she said, you might need to move into the city. You might need to change your environment. Because it's one of those things where, and I was thinking she was going to stand up for yourself, stay put, but she more or less said, you got to find your tribe and get the fuck out of there. And so I eventually did move out of there, but I just moved further out into like horse country where there was nobody. So I moved to total isolation. But and then eventually I moved to Asheville, where I did find a more open community. But I just liked her, and I liked what she said to me, because it got me to thinking. It planted a seed, and I needed somebody like that to plant a seed that it was okay to leave. It was okay to not stand and fight, because, yeah, I might get the shit beat out of me if I stay and fight or get killed. I would probably get killed because I wouldn't stop fighting. So that was my my little moment of meeting Gloria Steinem, and I'm very grateful that I did, because it did set me on course to change some things and to make changes to ultimately get me to a better place to live, so that I'm not constantly looking over my shoulder.
Hammered is recorded and produced in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. It's narrated by Jill Haney, produced by Jill Haney, and with sound design, editing, and music by Alexander Rodriguez. Our beautiful artwork was created by Lauren Caddick, and we'd like to send a special thanks out there to Minnie and Robin. You can check out our website, podcasthammered.com, and follow us on social media for updates.